Hello there, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Sports Pro podcast. My name is George Breer. I'm a senior content manager here at Sports Pro, and today I'm joined, or I'm flanked, I should say, by probably the best front three in sports media. So alongside me to my right, I have Mr. Tom Bassam, Sports Pro's news editor, and my co-host, as always, on the Sports Pro podcast. And on my left, a new substitute in for this week, we have Sam Karp, our features editor. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for having me. I think this is the first time I've been on in about 6 months where it isn't to talk about cricket. So I'm sure we'll find a way, but I'm very excited.
That can always change at the drop of a hat, Sam. Don't you worry about that. There's always cricket going on. Tom, it's nice to see you again. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thanks, mate. How are you getting on with watching the Tour de France?
This it's been a tricky week on that front. You know, I'm worked like a cart horse here at Sports Pro, so I've been trying to carve out time as hard as I can to catch the Tour de France. But given that we're off to Sports Pro APAC in a few weeks, and I think I have an 11-hour flight to contend with, maybe I can binge watch the series for you.
Yeah, I mean, minimum requirement, I think, at this point, mate, to be honest.
Now, gents, we're in the thick of the summer sporting calendar. This weekend marked the Wimbledon final. Did you both catch it?
Impossible not to, wasn't it? I think I was juggling between that and the Women's Ashes, which had a pretty thrilling finish. Unfortunately, didn't go England's way, but yeah, it was like multi-screening. Kind of reminded me a little bit of a few years ago when they had the 2019 World Cup final and Wimbledon going on at the same time. It was kind of similar vibes to that, where I was like running between two different rooms, whereas on this occasion I managed to figure out how to stream on my phone and the telly at the same time. So
I know. Well, the modern sports media landscape is a wonderful place now. I think I had my iPad and my laptop sort of perched on two sides, desperately trying to catch both, having got on a train back from Bath.
I took a more linear approach to it. So the morning was really all about watching the Scottish Open. Congratulations to Rory McIlroy on a fantastic performance winning that. Actually, unbelievable finish on the last two holes. And then I went for the Women's Ashes over for the Wimbledon final. Just thought that Djokovic was going to win, and I hate watching Djokovic win. So I thought, I'll see if England can take that. Unfortunately, they didn't, but that was a great one day match. And yeah, then I watched the last minute or so of Alcaraz, which was fine.
Which was fine. Tom, well, you weren't one of the 11 plus million people tuning in, but a pretty great tournament for Wimbledon from that broadcast point of view. And Sam, I knew we'd be talking about cricket sooner rather than later, and that was preempted by you. So I'm going to wash my hands clean of any responsibility.
You don't have to do it, mate. It's just because you're here, I pander to you. It's kind of, you lull me into it.
That's what we like to hear. Now, after Wimbledon, this week is another hugely exciting week in the summer sporting calendar. We have the Women's Soccer World Cup taking place in Australia and New Zealand. Now, there has been a little bit of controversy surrounding the tournament, particularly around some of its sponsorship deals and its broadcast partnerships that have been struck. But that aside, for a moment, you both excited?
Absolutely, yeah. I've been looking at some of the kickoff times, and that is a bit of a challenge here, but I really am excited about watching this tournament. As great as sort of France 2019 was in terms of, like, I think people still talked about that as a great moment for women's football in terms of building that attention and people kind of really seeing it for what it is, which is a high quality sporting product. I don't think I'm mentally thinking about it in the same way as I was before. This isn't about, let me check out women's football and, oh, isn't it great for women's football that this thing's happening? I actually really want to watch this whole tournament as a fan and root for England as a fan in a way that, like, probably a bit embarrassed to admit, but I haven't previously. Especially given the chances for the Lionesses, I think this could be a very good tournament for us.
Definitely, from an English point of view, there's obviously huge excitement going into the tournament, given the success of the Euros and the sort of the trajectory that women's football in particular in this country has been on. But that's, I think that's a pretty shared view across the globe in many territories. I think FIFA expecting more than 2 billion viewers this year, just under double what was achieved for the 2019 France tournament. As you said, given the challenges that Australia and New Zealand presents with scheduling and broadcast times, that would be quite a vote of confidence in that as well. What about you, Sam?
Yeah, mate, I'm excited. As Tom said, I think like the mindset going into this tournament is a little bit different, because going into France, it was a lot about sort of, I guess, hope and sort of, it felt like a step towards women's football becoming more mainstream, whereas women's football is very much in the mainstream and public consciousness now. And I think there's more expectation going into these tournaments in terms of what they're going to deliver, which kind of like speaks to the number that you just quoted there. You know, 2 billion viewers is a really optimistic target for FIFA. I'm sure they'll find a way to say that they got there, whatever happens. But yeah, everyone kind of expects a really, really exciting tournament, and I'm sure we're going to get it over the course of the next 4 weeks.
Well, speaking of the broadcast schedule, there has been a lot of conversation in the lead up to this year's tournament around the broadcast agreements. I think there's quite a bit to unpick here, and it sort of starts with FIFA's decision to unbundle the broadcasting commercial rights from the men's tournament. Sam, do you want to sort of just take me on that journey a little bit?
Yeah, so obviously historically FIFA has sold the rights to the Women's World Cup almost as like an add-on, I guess, to the Men's World Cup. So broadcasters would pay a rights fee and that fee would get them rights to the men's tournament, the women's tournament, but then also a host of other FIFA properties as well, so youth competitions, etc. Whereas what they've done this time round is quite similar to what we've seen a number of other governing bodies do, is they've essentially decided to sell them separately. The advantages of that are is that you can finally attribute a value directly to the women's tournament, which hasn't been done before. But at the same time, that's kind of a disadvantage, right? Because FIFA hasn't put a value on this tournament before. In a way, it's kind of undervalued the tournament by bundling it in with the men's. And so the problem they encountered this time around was that broadcasters weren't willing to pay what FIFA themselves thought it was worth or what they sort of expected the bids to be, which is why we've kind of had this protracted period of very sort of public negotiating by FIFA president Gianni Infantino, who was calling out the big five European broadcasters in particular for what he felt were kind of lowballing the tournament, offering very, very low bids. And ultimately, it kind of resulted in an 11th hour deal really close to the event kicking off, minimizing the amount of promotion that those broadcasters could do around the event. And ultimately, don't think it's really benefited anyone. But it's been an interesting thing to watch play out because, as I said, it's never happened before. FIFA has never had to sell these rights separately in the past. But I think it's been a little bit of a rude awakening for them in terms of the, I guess, the challenges of taking that approach.
FIFA are probably no strangers to taking a lot of criticism in terms of how they go about these things. But Tom, do you think there's any validity to Infantino's continued calls that the broadcasters are essentially almost like taking the mic, right? They're massively lowballing and massively undervaluing the value of these rights.
There definitely is a grain of truth to that. I think that's probably why that argument landed as well as it did, at least publicly anyway. I think, though, what Sam said about the fact that they hadn't valued these rights before, that made it harder, I think, for them in those sales negotiations and those talks. And that's been really borne out in what they've managed to achieve. So there was a report which came out in the Wall Street Journal at the end of last week, basically saying that FIFA had missed its broadcast revenue target by $100 million. So they'd set a $300 million revenue target. They managed to achieve a $200 million return. Given as well that $150 million of that was from kind of agreements that were longstanding. So deals in the US with Fox, that runs all the way up to 2026. Like, given that half of that $300 million was being accounted for in those kind of deals, they've really only added an extra $50 million of income from those rights sales, which, I mean, it's not insignificant, but at the same time, it suggests they haven't achieved what they wanted to at all. Like, they've achieved essentially a third of what they wanted to in terms of extra sales. So the argument stands. I think probably this will maybe serve better for the next tournament. I mean, that they can go into that with a stronger positioning, especially if they bring in the sort of numbers that they're projecting or manage to massage their way up to that re-billion figure or whatever it is for viewers. It'll end up being more of a long-term argument as opposed to why it didn't happen for this tournament.
You said that the arguments played out pretty well publicly, but it struck me that actually FIFA got a huge amount of criticism, and Infantino in particular received a huge amount of criticism for essentially inevitably going towards a blackout. And that was regularly the phrase that was quoted, that, you know, FIFA's pushing the broadcasters too hard and essentially we're going towards a media blackout, which would be unacceptable. The latter part of that is true. The broadcast blackout would be unacceptable. But I think so too were some of the bids that have been quoted. I think we put on our site that an Italian broadcaster bid £283,000 for the Women's World Cup. Same broadcaster bid £137 million for the men's tournament. So we're seeing nearly 500 times more being bid for the Men's World Cup. Those maths clearly don't add up in terms of reach, in terms of, you know, the ability to monetize that in the home markets. So there's just no, I just can't see any way in which, you know, they're gaining 500 times the amount of revenue from the men's tournament compared to the women. So there is also, you know, an abdication of responsibility here from some of the home broadcasters and host broadcasters, that they are not putting the investment behind where there is clearly demand and where there is clearly interest within their markets.
Yeah, true. But you could also flip that around and say, well, last time they were buying rights to multiple tournaments, and this time they're buying the rights to one. So where that might be interesting is when the negotiations come around for the Men's World Cup, and suddenly those same broadcasters are saying, well, I'm going to pay you less for the Men's World Cup because I'm not getting the Women's World Cup anymore.
But if they're bidding £283,000, yeah, which is what they see as the subset of that tournament, yeah, they're still seeing the Men's World Cup as 136 plus million.
Well, I mean, they are then, but they might not in the next cycle. I mean, I completely agree with you. That is a derisory offer. And like, compared to the impact that it potentially could have in terms of audience and what they're able to do with that viewership figure, then it is unacceptable. So in that regard, FIFA are right. But like, there's going to be a correction in the market, I think, as a result of all of this. It will take maybe a tournament cycle to completely iron out.
It was really interesting to watch the whole narrative play out, because I think when Infantino first like voiced his concerns about the value of the offers, he actually got a lot of public support, or there were a lot of people kind of backing his view. I think, Tom, even on this podcast, you put yourself on Team Gianni for the first time in living memory. But kind of as we got closer and closer to the tournament, everyone sort of started to realize that, you know, while the revenue is great and the investment that there is investment that needs to go into women's football, the reach is just as significant, especially for a tournament that is so important for growing the exposure of women's football and female footballers. And the closer that tournament got, the less exposure those players were getting, the less promotion they were getting, and FIFA's stance became harder to defend, I suppose. And it sort of goes back to the point I was making initially about, it goes back to sort of decades, really, of FIFA themselves undervaluing women's football. You know, if you're a broadcaster and you've like historically had the Women's World Cup included as part of a wider deal, they're pretty much within their rights to turn around and say, well, you know, you've given this tournament to us as part of a bundle in the past. Now you're telling us we need to pay more than what we're offering. I think, you know, that's a negotiating position which would have been pretty easy for them to take.
But there's also a responsibility there, right? If the responsibility on FIFA is to take a financial hit compared to the valuation, same true for the broadcasters.
There's the responsibility. But as I say, they haven't put a value on it in the past. So how are they meant to know what the value is at this point going forward? So it was a really interesting one to watch play out. Although I think a really interesting stat, which kind of almost just goes against the point that I just made, but I think the figures that we have for the last Women's World Cup, 1.12 billion people watched that. The figures from Qatar, I don't think have come out yet, like the full figures, but the 2018 Men's World Cup, there were 3.5 billion people that watched it. That's, so basically you're saying that the Women's World Cup gets 30% of the viewership of the men's, and yet you're looking at the value that the broadcasters are placing on it, that brands, partners are placing on it. It's really not reflected in that same way. And, you know, that's, you know, supposedly if that's how people are weighing up their bids, it wasn't, that isn't kind of what came through, but yeah, that was an interesting stat. You know, I think people would be kind of be surprised that it's, you know, the percentage of the audience is actually that high. It's quite interesting.
I don't think you can view anything where, for example, like in Japan, where they've literally just agreed to the broadcast rights for the tournament with the public service broadcaster a week before the tournament, as anything other than an abject failure on both sides. Like, they're not, like, NHK aren't serving the public well, and FIFA aren't serving the game well by stalling on a deal to a week before the tournament starts. Like, this is Japan, a massive market in the right time zone for this tournament. Japan won the tournament 2011. Like, there is public interest in the Japanese women's team. They play, like, their players play all over the world. They're big stars. That, like, that to me says that something is, like, fundamentally wrong with the process, and that something fundamentally went wrong with those negotiations. If that's the position you reach, like, that is unacceptable in so many levels. But in terms of when you're talking about a major sporting property and the governing body running it.
Yeah, I think that that's an important point. It's not quite so binary as, you know, the responsibility from one side or the other. Actually, as you say, that the complete inability or unwillingness from both sides to reach a compromise that has the greater interest of the game in mind, as well as the commercial considerations, is just an abject failure from both parties.
Yeah, NHK hasn't probably been able to market the fact that it's showing the tournament, which, when you've got something as sizable as the Women's World Cup is being positioned as, that's not great for the tournament. People will need to know where they're going to be able to watch it. I've spent the last week or so compiling the broadcast list for this tournament for our upcoming commercial guide, and there's still gaps missing in it from major nations. Like, there's still not deals done where there's still uncertainty over who's broadcasting it. Malaysia being one, Indonesia another. That might just be communications within those countries. But at the same time, those are big nations in the region, and currently it's unsure who's going to be broadcasting them when kickoff comes around.
I know FIFA have signed a deal, I think, with Sky Media to work with them on the monetization of FIFA Plus as a platform. Do you see that as a bit of a bullish move to essentially say to the broadcasts, if you're not willing to share you know, we will, and we'll try and, I guess, show the potential commercial value of what you can get here.
I don't know if that's necessarily on the live side of things personally. I think most of the major markets are accounted for now. If FIFA is going to be showing it in sort of some of the markets where it hasn't agreed a broadcast deal, then that makes sense. But also I think that deal is probably more intended to sort of commercialize against some of the other content that they've got on there. You know, the FIFA Plus offering, while there is some live stuff on there, I don't think it's ever necessarily been intended to be the home of the Women's World Cup or the Men's World Cup, for example. But some of the, obviously sort of some of the sort of lower tier, maybe youth properties that don't necessarily get those major broadcast deals, there's opportunities to commercialize that on the platform through ad deals. Similarly, loads of the original programming that they produce as well. So I don't know if that was necessarily a statement in that regard, but it gives them a fallback option, I guess, and is sort of another way that they can monetize all of the content that they're going to be producing for that platform.
We've alluded to the potential ramifications of how late these deals have been signed, both in terms of promotion, but I guess more crucially for those broadcasters in terms of selling advertising slots. Tom, you mentioned Fox Sports being one of those pre-existing agreements that has obviously had that building window. And there has been advertising interest. I think they've mentioned that they've had 90% of their ad inventory sold as of the beginning of June. You'd assume that's probably at 100% by now. So there are clearly commercial partners that are willing to back this and clearly advertising interest. For other broadcasters, potentially in some of the big five markets that have been much later to the party, how catastrophic do you think it's going to be in terms of gaining that commercial interest from advertisers and other parties to support them?
The thing is, most of those kind of remaining markets, the rights have gone to public service broadcasters. So not public service, but commercial networks. So in the UK, it's being split by the BBC and ITV. I'm sure ITV will do a decent job in selling them, but it will definitely impact that run-in if you're not able to go out. I mean, like, we know as a business how long it takes to bring in the right commercial deals around the right things. And if you end up doing those late, then it's not going to be as effective and you're not going to be able to capitalize on it in the same way. That partly falls on the nature of those big group deals. So that was done by the EBU and FIFA, as opposed to individually being struck between FIFA and ITV and FIFA and the BBC. So yeah, you are kind of, yeah, you're at the mercy of those talks, really. But I guess the kind of flip side on that is that ultimately ITV will have been targeting it. They'll have known it can only go to us, Channel 4, Channel 5, in terms of a commercial free-to-air network. We'll be getting max half of these games, so they may well have had stuff lined up. But undoubtedly, like, it's just basic human nature, isn't it? Like, things take time to sell. You can't just flog them immediately. Like, TV advertising is something that, like, especially with something like the FIFA World Cup, you want to have brands that are aligned with that tournament. They need to come up with the campaigns that they're going to be pushing around it. So it impacts the whole ecosystem, not just the broadcasters, but the agencies creating those campaigns, the brands that are sort of working with them. There's a whole thing there that will have had a very significant period of its run into the tournament hampered.
Sam, as Sports Pro's resident sponsorship guru, I wanted to pick your brains on FIFA's decision to unbundle the rights. Tom mentioned earlier, it's kind of an important line in the sand, not just for now in this tournament, but very much setting a precedent for future editions. You know, alongside that, Infantino himself has said that he wants to drag broadcasters, quote, kicking and screaming on that commercialization route. So how successful do you think their decision has been to unbundle the rights? And that's both now for this tournament, but also looking ahead to, you know, an important landmark.
Yeah, I think it's probably way too early to say if it's been a success or a failure. I think there's, like, it's quite easy to make a mistake with women's football of expecting all of the growth to be really linear, when in reality you have to kind of expect that there's going to be some growing pains along the way, some stumbling blocks, like I guess we've seen with this tournament. But as Tom mentioned before, like, we've kind of got a value now that we can attribute to the women's game in terms of media rights, and that $200 million figure that, you know, that wasn't attributable to the women's game before. Another thing that FIFA has done recently is kind of overhauled its commercial partnership structure, which basically allows brands to align specifically with the women's game. So they can align specifically with the Women's World Cup, they can align specifically with the Men's World Cup, they can align specifically with their esports tournaments if that's a better fit for them. The only sort of women's football partners that they've announced since then are Visa and Xero, who I think both of which have also aligned with UEFA's women's football. I'm sure they would have liked to have more brands aligned with them on that front. But at the same time, that's two brands contributing revenue again that can be directly attributed to the women's game that wasn't directly attributed to the women's game before.
Unilever also have some like female specific brands attached to the event, I think.
Unilever has a World Cup sponsorship, so they're a sponsor of this tournament, but also the men's tournament. And then there are actually a ton of regional supporters of this tournament specifically as well, which is one area where FIFA has seen some growth on the sponsorship side. So I think, as I said, it's a little bit too early to say whether the decision to unbundle has been a success or a failure. I think you kind of have to give it time and see how it plays out over a couple of cycles rather than just one before you can kind of deliver a verdict. But generally speaking, I think it's better to let these properties stand on their own two feet, just so you can actually get a sense of, you know, what they're worth, and then also what needs to be done, what changes need to be made to make it more appealing commercially to those broadcasters, to those brands. Because I don't think it's helpful trying to attribute value to properties that are bundled up as part of a massive package, and kind of that unbundling process is a really important step in terms of understanding what the women's game is really worth.
Yeah, it definitely feels as if, you know, pretty much all of the content we're producing around women's sports, particularly across our events, which is more my domain, constantly hearing the same message of the need to unbundle, and essentially you're catering to very different audiences, and therefore you have a unique opportunity to cater to different brands that traditionally may not have had the greatest footprint in the sponsorship space. I think you look at some of the brands that Unilever have talked about activating at the Women's World Cup, and very, very different, obviously, and understandably, to what there is on the men's side of things. And they're probably a bit more of a unique brand in that they're able to match up, you know, a vast portfolio of brands to the different properties.
Yeah, and it lowers the price point in a way, right? I mean, like, the World Cup is probably one of the most expensive sponsorships you can buy as a brand, which is why it's always been, you know, your Coca-Cola's, your McDonald's, a lot of Chinese brands have been sponsoring the World Cup over the past few years. And, you know, by unbundling, it sort of opens up the pool to choose from, basically. You're going to get more brands entering the space, either because, you know, they think they can act, it's something that they're actually able to afford now, it's within their marketing budget, but also it's a point that, again, I've made regularly in my sponsorship newsletter, and that we make regularly across Sports Pros platforms, is that some brands see the values of the women's game being more closely aligned with their own, and they want to engage with the women's football audience more than they do the men's. So being able to align with that tournament specifically is appealing to some of those companies.
That's a really good point. I remember last year when we did Women's Sports Week for 2022, we did a sort of a breakfast event, and one of the brands that we had in attendance there, they mentioned that their partnerships in women's sports were actually something that was regularly cited by their employees as a well-being benefit's the wrong word, but an active point of employee engagement and a general sense of sort of mission and satisfaction of working where they do, which I definitely don't think you'd see the same extent to in the men's game. Moving away from that broadcast base, I could chat to you both all day on that. I wanted to look a little bit at the engagement levels you anticipate for this year's tournament. FIFA have obviously put that 2 billion figure down in terms of overall viewership, as we've already said, nearly double what it was for 2019. An interesting roadmap of how they're going to get there. But what was your take on that top line figure? Sam, I'll come to you first.
As you mentioned at the start, George, basically that's nearly double what they got for the last one. We should also caveat the fact that whatever numbers they release, because, you know, we won't just get a figure on the viewership, we'll probably get a figure on video views, social media engagement, all the various different metrics that organizations like to use now to fluff up the numbers and make them look like they were better than they perhaps. Yeah, exactly.
We do that with the podcast, obviously.
we should caveat with that, with the fact that this tournament is the first 32-team Women's World Cup. There are 8 more teams than there were last time round, which means there are going to be 12 more games. So that will naturally inflate the numbers in some way, you imagine. But I think also you can't ignore the time zone element. We didn't mention it when we were talking about the broadcast stuff, but I'm sure that will have played a part in the bids that were made. It's going to impact the way people engage with the tournament, basically. Less people are going to be watching this tournament live, I'd imagine. More people are going to be consuming highlights. They're going to be consuming it across different platforms. I personally don't think there'll be many people waking up in the middle of the night for a ton of the group stage games that aren't involving their team. So that's obviously going to affect the engagement. So yeah, I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about growth not being linear. You know, it's not necessarily going to be on this steady trajectory. I think I think any increase at this tournament is going to be positive, because the more, if you do see that growth, that means that there are more people engaging with the Women's World Cup and women's football that weren't before. And I think that would be kind of like a positive measure to take away from this, especially because, you know, there have been some well-documented challenges going into this tournament. So it will kind of be interesting to see what impact those do ultimately have.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a tournament where really your best measures for engagement are going to be in the, like, do the things that we think are going to be a big hit, are they a big hit? Are the games involving Australia going to be a big hit in their home markets? Are the US women's national team games going to be a big hit on Fox? Are people going to tune in to FTV, RTV, BBC, ITV when England, Spain, Italy and France are playing? It's going to be about those, I think, for this tournament. Because it's not still at that point where we're at a groundswell of like popular culture. Like it's not completely all-encompassing in the way that the Men's World Cup is. There are still challenges out there, but it's going to be about those big markets. I should mention Scandinavia in there as well. That's a big old powerhouse in terms of women's football. So that's for me, I think, the things that will matter. And like those should be quite trackable throughout the tournament. But then as well, for the Brown side, how are they going to measure success in this? What counts as success in this for them? That's not going to be, I think, some of the more traditional metrics. I think like some of that is going to be measured differently. And that's just the way that it has to be, I think, with this tournament.
What about some of the metrics beyond just live broadcast? Or even highlights across those big broadcasters that you mentioned, Tom? I know FIFA have announced collaborations with Roblox, for instance. Obviously, they have an existing partnership for FIFA World that has covered the men's tournament as well. TikTok is also another important partner for some of the like non-live content. Given the sort of demographic that we see in women's sports shifting, so obviously being geared towards younger audiences, sort of non-traditionally sports fans, I guess, do you see those platforms playing a huge role given some of the time zone challenges?
As Sam said, like highlights and clips are going to be a big part of this. Like, yeah, in Europe, we aren't going to be getting up at X o'clock in the morning to watch those games. So wherever, like whichever social feed it is you use to consume that content, that's got to be executed correctly in order to make sure we're able to consume this in the way that it needs to be. You've got that full understanding of what's going on in that green game that you haven't watched. So I think so. I think the age profile of women's football fans and appealing more generally to younger and Gen Z fans will help in that department. They're more likely to be on those platforms looking for that content. And I think TikTok especially is going to be making a big play out of that. It's done that throughout the last couple of years with women's sports, with the Six Nations especially, but plenty of other ways as well. There was a really good blog written for us by Rollo Goldstaub during our Women's Sports Week last week, who's the head of sport for UK and the Nordics, about what we should be looking out for and what works when it comes to women's sports content and how that's going to appeal. I encourage people to check that out. And That I think is going to be, yeah, where we see a lot of value being driven from.
There's been strong engagement in, I think you've talked about this already, Tom, is the engagement we're seeing in the local market in Australia and New Zealand. The ticket sale target of 1.5 million, I think, has been hit or is extremely close to being hit, which is a significant bump on the previous record of tickets sold. How important is that local sort of like in-stadium engagement compared to something like more global broadcast numbers?
I think Australia's had a better time doing this than maybe New Zealand, where, I mean, Australia has that established A-League's property. It's got a much stronger national team, much stronger domestic game. But I think it's been a bit more of a struggle for New Zealand based on some of the reports that I've been reading. I think as of last week, less than half of the 900,000 tickets that were available in the country have been sold. So there's still a lot to do in New Zealand, whereas Australia, I think, is tracking in a much more positive direction. So that's the interesting nature, or the nature of the beast when it comes to splitting up tournament hosting duties. And that could be something that we see also like spill forward into the men's tournament. That's going to be split across North America in 2026. So you're not just kind of breaking it down into home, like a home market, you're breaking it down into several, or in this case two, and they have their challenges as well. So it's even more like, I think it's even more like localized than just saying the host nations. You're looking at which host nation is, they're almost competing against each other at this point.
Now, The one of the final things I wanted to talk about, and I don't want to labor too much on some of the negative press surrounding the tournament, because there is obviously a huge amount of excitement, but it would be wrong for us not to talk about the equal pay controversy that's sort of particularly been apparent in the last couple of weeks. So FIFA announced $150 million prize fund for this year's Women's World Cup. That's a 300% increase from the 2019 pot, but equally importantly, it's just a third of what the Qatar Men's World Cup prize fund was. So given the backdrop of obviously a significant increase, but still a significant shortfall compared to the Men's World Cup, it almost sits, you know, bang in the middle of where it was and where it needs to be. What was your take on that, Sam?
The equal pay conversation is so polarizing. And I think, so obviously this week, a lot of people have seen the video of the Australian team, the Matildas, pushed out a video on social media, and then I think it was their captain did a press conference essentially calling for FIFA to equalize pay. Part of me thinks, like, you know, 300% is a big increase up to 100. I think it's the prize money itself is 110 million, but then there's an additional sort of 42 million, which is going towards like assisting with travel and that kind of stuff. But yeah, as you say, it's still like nothing in comparison to what the men get. But I think like when we're talking about this, it's so easy to get caught up in that argument about, well, just because the women's tournament generates X amount of money, then they shouldn't be getting the same amount of money as the men. That's the argument that's obviously kind of made, and it's really easy to get wrapped up in that. I think what's like really, really interesting this year is that FIFA has essentially ring-fenced a proportion of that funding. So it's basically going to be paid to the players specifically, to ensure that, and this is actually a quote from FIFA that I've got written down, that they are adequately compensated for their contribution and work. So each player in the group stage, for example, who plays is going to get $30,000, which is kind of quite sensational, really, because I think it's basically FIFA saying that it doesn't trust its own member federations to reinvest the prize money that they receive back into the women's game, back into the women's football players. And kind of the context for all this is that FIFA basically did that after FIFPro, who is the global players union, essentially challenged FIFA to guarantee that some of the money from that prize fund goes directly to the players, because FIFPro themselves did a survey on the back of World Cup qualification where 29% of the players, so nearly a third of the respondents, said they hadn't been compensated for playing in World Cup qualifying. And 66% had had to take unpaid leave or vacation to play for the national team. This whole equal pay debate, you know, you can talk about the headline number all you want, but I think it's also down to the member federations and their appetite to invest in women's football as well, which is why I think like moments like this, tournaments like this are so important, especially as it's expanding to 32 teams. It's going to be really interesting because it has the potential to like really highlight the disparity that exists. You know, we talk a lot about the disparity between the men's and the women's game, but there's already a big disparity developing in the women's game itself, where you've got some of those federations like England's Football Association, like US Soccer, who have been investing more, kind of have had the resources to invest more in their women's teams. And then you have some of those other lower ranked sides who don't have access to the same resources, or maybe don't prioritize their women's teams in the same way. And that could lead to some lopsided fixtures like we saw at the last tournament, which is going to impact that product, which isn't going to benefit anybody. So I think that's going to be a really, really important part of this tournament, is essentially, yes, we have that sort of equal pay debate, but ultimately what comes out of this, it's going to be really important that those member federations that are participating essentially are coming away from it, reinvesting back into their women's football operations and kind of making sure that they come back in 4 years like more developed and kind of benefiting the global game.
Yeah, I mean, adding to that though, it's not just those kind of smaller federations that are, like, this is something that they're dealing with. The Lionesses has literally confirmed today that they are pausing their discussions on pay with the FA, so that the players can concentrate on like succeeding at the tournament. Now, like, that to me says that should have been wrapped up a while ago. There were sort of reports in the last month or so about them not being happy with the system for bonuses, and the FA were then kind of pointing the finger back at FIFA for not addressing that. But if the FA, and like we take the FA as being fairly progressive on this kind of stuff, is still got issues with its players, then think about those places that perhaps like aren't as high profile and aren't, the pressure isn't maybe there from the domestic media in the same way, and that the narrative isn't at the same point as it is here. it's clearly not a battle that's been won and clearly not an argument that's been settled. You don't really hear these kind of things coming up so much in the men's games. You do occasionally from the smaller nations. I think famously, like I think it was Trinidad, like the 2006 World Cup. But I mean, and there are probably others since then, but that's just the last one I can think of. But it's not the same. And it's like we're still talking about massive developed nations with federations with big budgets, not investing in the levels that its players deem acceptable still in 2023.
Yeah. Canada soccer as well. They've had a really long running pay dispute.
They're Olympic champions.
Yeah. And there's the case of Jamaica. As recently as 2 weeks ago, there was a story about one of the players' mothers essentially started a crowdfunding page because the players didn't feel they were getting the right financial support from the federation about things as basic as, you know, a training camp, travel to the tournament. You know, they were like wondering if they were even going to be able to get to Australia and New Zealand to compete. You know, it was such like basic things and things that, you know, would not be an issue in a men's World Cup. I think tournaments like the Women's World Cup are great, and it's an important moment to celebrate women's football and the sort of growth trajectory that it's on. But it's also really, really important in highlighting these instances and kind of highlighting the reality that a lot of female footballers around the globe face, because for all the sort of landmark sponsorship deals, landmark broadcast deals that have been signed, those sort of big attendance figures that we see sort of every few months, it's not the sort of week-to-week, day-to-day reality for a lot of women's football players. And I think the World Cup is a really important moment to highlight that.
That's definitely been my biggest takeaway from preparing for today and just doing a look at some of the numbers. As you say, Sam, pretty much all of the reach and interest metrics that we see are almost like two times in across the board, right? Record attendance is pretty much a weekly occurrence at the moment in something like the WSL, or broadcast figures are hugely on the increase in terms of viewers. The TikTok numbers that we talked about there, they're hugely on the rise also in the billions in terms of the use of the hashtag, but it's just not being matched when it comes to investment or prize money or, you know, broadcast contracts or sponsorship contracts. And that disconnect there isn't simply a logical or a mathematical one. That's a lack of investment and a lack of drive that comes from those organizations. And the takeaway from the tournament is, yes, there will be lots of excitement. Yes, there will be records broken undoubtedly in terms of, you know, viewers, in terms of engagement, but there is still a huge mountain to climb and a huge challenge being faced to get that buy-in commercially from other areas.
Yeah, Gianni Infantino said back in March that it's his ambition for the 27 World Cup and the 26 World Cup to offer equal prize money. That's not like a firm commitment, maybe as best you'll get. I think he should be held to that. And if they fail to match it, then again, like it'd be really sad if we were still having this conversation in 4 years' time.
I think the optics of the impacts it would have by equalising prize money, it's not just as simple as, you know, whoever deserves to be paid more because this tournament generates more money. The fact of the matter is, if FIFA made that step of equalising prize money, you're sending the message to those other member federations as well that the Women's World Cup, winning the Women's World Cup is just as important as winning the Men's World Cup, and you're going to get the same money for doing so. At the moment, those federations see that bigger prize money and they see, you know, a bigger cash reward for reaching the Men's World Cup and for succeeding at that tournament. That's why they're investing more on the men's side of things rather than the women's. If they were to equalise that prize money at the very top, then that would have a trickle effect all the way down.
And we've just seen it from the ICC, haven't we? Like, it's just announced that it's going to be equalising its prize money in all of its international cricket competitions. All right, not as big a sport globally as football, despite George's great ambitions. But
that's next week's podcast.
But as Sam says, it sends that message that you've got to prioritise this in the same way, and you'll be rewarded for doing so.
And speaking of the messages to be sent, FIFA has justifiably come under huge levels of criticism over the last 18 months, particularly on the back of the Qatar World Cup. Do you think there is justification that FIFA should be praised in the approach they've taken for this Women's World Cup? They've been far more bullish about the commercial prospects of the women's game. Obviously, there is a degree of self-interest in that. But the increase in prize money, and to Sam's, I think, really interesting point of how they're distributing that prize money, probably more importantly, there is a big statement being made here from FIFA. Or do you not share that view? I want to try and get you on Team FIFA just twice, Tom. No, jokes aside, there's no horse in this race from my point of view.
Am I on Team FIFA for this tournament? No, but that's not to be said that it hasn't done things that should be applauded. I'm actually not sure that it was the right move to go to an expanded tournament. That could be something that backfires when you see sort of lots of one-sided games. There were still a lot of those in the last tournament, and then they made the field bigger. So whether or not there's enough quality to really like justify that product in this tournament, I'll be interested to see how that plays out. I really hope that it's the right call. I think that will probably be a major part of what goes into, like, not my thinking, but into like the public consciousness of whether or not that's worked. Then at the same time, that has also been used in order to monetize the game better. So it's kind of swings and roundabouts when it comes to those. There's a push and pull on those two things. So yeah, I don't think I can kind of completely whole endorse FIFA as the grand savior here or the knight in shining armor, but it's definitely trending in a positive direction. I think it's up to not just FIFA though, more the broader industry to look at this as well and ask what they can do better too.
I agree. Well, that Tom Bassam seal of approval is something that we all chase day to day. And I'm sure FIFA will be looking to it for future tournaments. Now, before I leave you, gents, I thought I'd ask you for your predictions from a sporting point of view. Who do you think will be contesting the final? Who do you think will be the winner? And who's your surprise package for the tournament?
I'm going to go bold and say England win. I think that they've got a really strong squad, like a lot of really high quality players. The WSL's been improving massively over the last few years. I've got a feeling actually that if it's not England, the winner will come from Europe. I think the US women's national team may have a bit of a shock when it comes to the standard of of European football and the fact that it could kind of quite bullish Fox advert that they put out a few weeks ago. I don't know if anyone's seen that, about how the rest of the world can stop the US women's national team, might prove to look a little bit foolish. But if it doesn't, then I will look a little bit foolish.
It's big and bold, Tom. I like it. Sam?
I'm going for the opposite. I'm going to say the US women's national team are going to win because they always do. They've won two of the last three. It's likely to be the last tournament for some of their biggest stars. And they always make so much noise going into it as well, like unapologetically so. It would be... I haven't really seen how the path to the final, but it would be nice if they were playing England in that final because there is a bit of a rivalry developing there, it feels. But yeah, whenever I think of the Women's World Cup, I think of the US Women's National Team lifting the trophy. So it's hard for me to see past that again for this edition. Big part of me kind of would like to see the hosts do well, given, you know, everything we've spoken about in terms of, you know, I don't think it's been ideal preparation with COVID and everything that's in the run up to it. They've got the sort of face of the tournament in Sam Kerr. They've sold a lot of tickets for it, and that kind of local engagement and filling those stadiums is going to be really important for how the tournament is perceived. So the further Australia go, the more those stadiums are probably going to be full, and the longer they're going to retain that interest. So kind of selfishly from that perspective, I hope Australia perform quite well. I don't know if that counts quite as a surprise package. I guess the other ones I'd say, I don't know if they count as a surprise either, but Brazil for me would be interesting. I think Marta has said it's her last tournament. They gave England a good run in the final ISMA. So yeah, maybe them. We'll see.
I don't think we should let this podcast end without George giving his own predictions as well. So where are you coming down on all this?
Well, now you put me on the spot, this is going to sound like a cop-out because I really should have gone before Sam because he has quite quickly stolen both my winning prediction and my surprise package. So I'll evolve it slightly. I do think the US Women's National Team will win. I think there's a bit of a poetic ending, you know, with Megan Rapinoe retiring, etc. And as you say, I think it's a bit of an end of an era for that side. I also think they are reaping the rewards of greater investment, earlier drive towards professionalism as well, which I think is something, even with, you know, nationalistic tendencies that come with the World Cup, that shouldn't be ignored. So there's a bit of a goodwill story there. My surprise package is going to be New Zealand. New Zealand to go far. Quarterfinals at least.
Never won a Women's World Cup group stage game. You're backing them for the quarters.
Backing them for the quarters. I'm going big and I'm going bold.
Could be a repeat of South Korea 2002.
If I'm right, Tom, you'll never have to ask me about the Tour de France ever again. Deal?
I can't make any promises there.
Maybe we'll get you to do a Gary Lineker and do the podcast in your boxes or something like that. we'll leave our listeners with that wonderful image for the rest of the week. Sam and Tom, as always, it's been a pleasure podding with you, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, chaps. Enjoy the World Cup.